everyone. First off, Happy New Year. Happy 2021. We have a reboot episode for you today. This was originally released October of 2017. A lot has happened since the recording of this episode that has put the destruction of art, statues, at the forefront of our minds, especially here in America. So we will likely do an updated episode or maybe an episode focusing more on those ideas in a contemporary political context at some point, but there's still a lot of good theoretical concepts surrounding the destruction of art in this episode, so hopefully you enjoy that. Also, if you want to help us get to our first goal of being able to release new content every week, head on over to our Patreon, patreon.com/arthistorybabes. There's all kinds of fun bonus content over there. We've got lots of bonus podcast episodes. We're starting to do some vlogs and reflections. We have our book club. There's also opportunities for like Zoom hangs with us, the Art History Babes. So yeah, head over to patreon.com/arthistorybabes. We're about 65% to our first goal. Once we get there, then we can guarantee content every week. So if you would like a more, you know, consistent release schedule, if you'd like more consistent content, we'd love to give that to you. And we very much appreciate all the support and all of our patrons. Also, becoming a patron gives you access to discussion boards on all of our full-length episodes. So there will be a discussion board on this episode and all on all of the ideas surrounding iconoclasm that you could come be a part of. patreon.com/arthistorybabes. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you for supporting and enjoy this episode, Smashing and Slashing, The Art of Iconoclasm. The Art History
Babes. Welcome to the podcast. I'm Corey.
I'm Nat.
I'm Ginny, and we are the Art History Babes.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
We're recording live from my new cottage.
Yeah.
So cute, you guys.
We love the cottage so life.
Cute. Yeah. We're just a bunch of cottage babes.
Cottage dwellers. Gnomes.
Gnomes.
I feel like a gnome often.
Yeah, as do I. Just that little, like, hermit life.
Yeah.
I like it. I like it. It's very pleasant.
Time to read and ponder one's life.
One's place in the world. Yeah.
I want to find a cottage.
I know. You next.
I know. I need one.
Yeah. You'll find your little cottage. This is my second one, and when I actually told a friend about it, he was just like, you really love living in cottages behind people's houses, don't you?
It's nice.
I was like, it's perfect. Like, if you ever have the opportunity, find a cottage.
Yeah. See? I miss mine.
Yeah, I mean, I live in a guest house behind my parents' house, but it's not cottagey enough.
Like, yeah, that's true. It's a little too modern.
It's too modern. It's a weird layout. It's like a giant Jack and Jill of, like, two studios.
Oh.
Think about it like that. Like,
interesting.
Like, giant rectangular rooms mirroring yeah. one another between with a kitchen and a bathroom between.
Yeah.
And it's kind of eerie.
Yeah, you get freaked out there sometimes.
I do. I have some weird dreams. Like, I actually am proud of myself when I sleep there and don't have weird dreams, which is never fully through the night, but, like, Matthew will leave at, like, 4:30, and then I'll go back to sleep till, like, 8:30 or 9.
Yeah.
And if I can do that without getting, like, creeped out or having weird dreams, I'm like, yeah. It's a win. That's yeah. a win.
Are they, like, pool house related dreams?
Yeah.
Like, what
oh,
happens?
Yeah. Oh.
Like, yeah, in the worst ones, I can hear someone walking around the room, but I
no,
can't move.
Uh-uh.
Oh, so is it like a
sleep
like,
paralysis?
Yeah. Kind of, yeah.
That's
but I don't know that it's full sleep paralysis because, I don't know, I've, like, looked it up and sometimes they're different, like, because sometimes I can get up, like, I've had them where, like, I hear people outside, there's a huge slider, like, that's how you get in. I have curtains up over it, but obviously, like, if there's ever light outside, it just, like,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You see the silhouettes of, like, everything out there.
Yeah.
Which is very creepy, especially since we have motion lights, so that's happened before.
Yes.
I've been woken up in the middle of the night, and then the light comes on out there, and I'm just like,
oh, no.
Fuck me right now.
Don't
I'm
like
gonna
that.
Die.
Yeah.
This is why I can't
awful.
Listen to my favorite murder.
Yeah.
Because if I listen to too much of that shit, I will just never sleep.
Yeah. And we're like, we're moving into the spookiest time of year, too.
Right? Yeah. Exactly.
Very true.
Yep.
So I don't want to be staying there too long. I've only been in there like a week now.
We're recording from there next time, aren't we?
Yeah. So you guys will get to weigh in. We'll get there and you'll be like, what's your problem? It's not bad. Like, during the day, it's great, whatever. Just at night, it's so eerie. You hear everything in the walls. Like, all the piping and stuff's just so loud. So there's so many creaks. I don't know. I'm a chicken, you guys. That's what it comes down to.
It's better to be wary and afraid than not afraid and clueless.
Well, then I'm set.
You gotta be aware.
That's actually what I tell myself when, like, my anxiety's acting up. Because anyone who has anxiety knows that a lot of times it is compounded because you get mad at yourself for being anxious.
Yeah.
So, like, when my anxiety is acting up, I try to remind myself that anxiety is actually just really good survival instincts. Just your body is going into fight or flight when it doesn't need to. Mm-hmm. But that means my survival instincts are really strong. And that is a good quality to have.
It is.
Yeah.
It really is.
Nice. Yeah.
No, my mom told me a while back, I wasn't at her house when this happened because I would have flipped out, but my mom lives like kind of up around like a very woodsy area, so there's
very
a lot of
cute
deer.
Your mom's house is just the best.
It's like a grown-up cottage.
It's like a Snow White
home.
Yeah,
it really is.
But it's,
so
but it's in an amazing location in the Oakland Hills.
Yeah. No, but she said the other night, because she has a motion detector light as well, and we have, she has a deck where, you know, little stairs come up to the deck, and, like, her house isn't closed off, so, like, critters can just, like, come right up. They do it often. Like, all kinds. Like, there's even little fox that run around there.
Aww.
But this night, she, like, got woken up and the motion detector light went off, and then she heard the sound of like hoofs clomping on the deck, but like really slowly, and I was like, Black Phillip.
Of course it's Black Phillip.
Black Phillip. But I think it was just like,
do you wish to live deliciously?
Who's Black Phillip?
Black Phillip? Sorry.
That has to
That's a good question, because I'm sure many people don't know who Black Phillip is.
And there are you, listeners.
That movie, The Witch, I feel like we've talked about it.
We've talked about it many times.
You guys have. I've never seen it.
We talked about it on the episode about Black.
Oh, yeah.
We talked about Black Phillip.
Yeah.
Also not here for.
Because, so Black Phillip is a black goat, and a lot of times the devil
goats.
Is associated with goats.
Unfortunately.
No fault to goats.
Yeah, I'm no goat.
No fault of the goat.
But when I heard, like, hooves.
Oh, yeah.
Clomping.
Definitely Black
middle
Phillip.
Middle of the night. Black Phillip.
Yeah, and in the movie, the creepy little children, who are literally the creepiest part of the movie.
Yeah, they are.
They just, like, run around. They're like, Black Phillip! Black Phillip!
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's creepy.
Safe to say I'm never watching this movie.
It's a great movie.
It
really is.
It is. And, like, scary, but not, like, jump out at you scary that much. It's more disturbing than anything.
There was one scene I couldn't watch, but other than that, I was fine. And I'm
if you can make
sensitive.
It through the first, like, 10 minutes or so, you're probably all right. Honestly, what's more scary about it is I feel like a very accurate depiction of what puritanical life was in early America.
Exactly.
Because that shit sucks.
Yeah. Well, one, it's beautifully shot.
Yes.
Like, the director is amazing. Like, it is so creepy, but just from an artistic perspective, the way the shots are done is amazing. It just makes it so much creepier and, like, so much more interesting. But exactly, the portrayal of puritanical American life and, like, witch hunts is horrifying.
Yeah, it really is.
But yeah, it's a great movie. We've talked about it, I think, at least 3 times on the podcast now, but you should all really watch it.
We'll see. Maybe once I'm out of the guest house, we'll talk about it.
There we could have a little Halloween movie night, and we could all watch it together. That would be fun. Today, we're going to kind of mix things up a little bit. We're going to do a listener mail at the beginning because it directly led to this episode.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I was really excited when I saw this email because it's a topic that I am really interested in. So it was a good suggestion. So give us your suggestions because we really do take a lot of them to heart. So this is from Kim from the Netherlands.
Ooh, dope girl.
She says, Dear Art History Babes, my reason to write, besides looking for an excuse to compliment you, is that in the 6th episode, she's earlier talking about a radio podcast series that's all in Dutch, none of us speak it, unfortunately. Otherwise, we totally listen to it. But
yeah, it sounded really cool, but yeah. I was like, I would have no luck with that.
Yeah. So in one of these episodes, they discuss a woman who, for feminist reasons, attacked a painting with an axe. And then in March of 1914, feminist Mary Richardson slashed a Velázquez painting in the National Gallery in London as a protest to the imprisonment of one of her fellow activists. On first sight, it seems she might have picked this painting at random, but it's a female nude that seems to me highly questionable. I didn't do any research on the topic besides listening to the radio series, but I thought it might be interesting to you. Again, I love your podcast. Keep on rocking. And if you ever happen to visit the Netherlands again, consider visiting the Kröller-Müller Museum. or maybe the Rijksmuseum. Rijksmuseum.
God. I know that
one. We almost went there.
Yeah, it's right by the Van Gogh Museum, the Rijksmuseum.
Cool. We saw it from afar, from across a field.
Yes.
There's lots of Vermeers and Rachel Roisch. Lots of her work is in the Rijksmuseum. Yeah. All your Dutch
homies.
Yeah, Dutch homies, pretty much.
They were doing good shit.
They were.
So, Kim, thank you for the suggestion to do an episode on iconoclasm. Here it is for you and everyone else. So the first thing, I took a seminar a while back that was on cultural heritage, was like the overarching theme, and a lot of what was talked about in there is iconoclasm and vandalism. So I'll start out by just kind of giving an overview of iconoclasm and vandalism and how they may differ. And also, both of the terms have changed over time and taken on kind of a wider umbrella of meaning with the progression of history. So I'll get into that a little bit. But a really good book, and we might have mentioned this before when we listed some of our favorite books about art, but if not, this book, The Destruction of Art, Iconoclasm and Vandalism Since the French Revolution by Dario Gamboni is really, really good for anyone who's interested in different examples of iconoclasm and vandalism, and it discusses it in all the political and religious context that it's fallen into leading up to the French Revolution, but then mostly French Revolution and after. So,
if I'm not mistaken, he wrote a lot about things like restoration and stuff as well. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because I think I used him as a source at one point. So just like ideas that involve the lifetime of an artwork.
Yeah, totally. And he's got some really big, cool ideas in this book. Highly recommend it. So mostly he explores the relationship between modern art and its destruction. Starting with iconoclasm and how it first emerged and really what it meant in its kind of origin. So iconoclasm in the beginning was primarily in regards to the destruction of religious images that were deemed heretical. When you're talking about icons, usually icons are paintings on smaller scales because they're meant to be for devotional purposes. So you'll have a painting of a saint or like the Virgin Mary. And the point when icons first started emerging during the Middle Ages, and they were super popular in Byzantium, that you look at these paintings and you pray to them, you know, for whatever you're praying for. And they're meant to be like a bridgeway or help enact prayer and reflection. But a lot of people on the opposite end felt that icons were heretical because people were worshiping the images themselves and not actually the divine beings that they represented. And so people started destroying icons, and those were called iconoclasts. So that's the first example we have.
Which is just like, I don't know, I've never quite understood that argument, this idea, because images have power because of the meaning we give them.
Right.
So if you're worshiping, you're not worshiping a piece of paper, you're worshiping the icon, you're worshiping the image of the thing, which is the thing. So I personally have never understood that, like, that religious argument that it's somehow not worshiping what it represents.
Right.
You know what I mean?
I kind of get it, actually. Not to, I mean, no, I'll play devil's advocate.
Please do.
I totally understand how, like, easy it would be to act like that thing in itself is what's holy versus what it represents. And I think that's what it comes down to. Like, let's say your house catches on fire and you run back in and risk your life to get this icon. And it's like, the icon doesn't change the being that it represents, but that person has put so much meaning into it that the thought of it being destroyed is like, Does that make sense? Takes on a life outside of the actual spiritual being, God, whatever that it represents. And I remember reading somewhere the Byzantine era had a lot to do with intersections of religion. So, there was a decent Muslim population Jewish, and those two religions specifically did not have a lot of figural representation and stuff. And so that was influenced.
Zero.
Exactly.
I think that argument, or putting it in that context, like the idea of running back into a burning building, that definitely makes sense. I would agree with the argument in that context, for sure.
It's a fine line, though, between having a representational object that represents something greater and putting too much weight on that object, which is what makes iconoclasm so interesting. If you can apply it to like so many things today.
I think for me, part of it is just my Catholic upbringing.
Oh,
and we fucking love our icons. Oh, yeah. It's all about the icons. I had to go to church every Friday in school, and I didn't mind, because I would just, like, stare at all the cool art and be like, praise Jesus.
Yeah. And there's a lot to that. You know who didn't like that shit? The Protestants.
Yeah.
So, next, Protestant Reformation. This is another huge upsurge in iconoclasm. So, Protestants, starting with Martin Luther, a lot of the problem that they had with the Catholic Church, well, they had many issues, but in terms of art, they felt that a lot of Catholic art was too extravagant and flashy and materialistic and expensive, and it was taking away from what was actually in the Bible and what they were meant to be practicing as Christians and all that. So Protestant art is very different. You know, like when you're looking at 17th century, like Dutch still lives, you know, they have ways of representing religious lessons and morals and all that without painting necessarily devotional things with saints. Like it might be more kind of subtle where you have a still life with a turned over wine glass and kind of decaying fruit to show, like, okay, you're gonna die, everyone is mortal. With that, you have kind of these disparities between art that is all about creating and kind of illustrating these divine figures, and that is considered a good thing, and then other religions, like the Protestants, who are not as into that and start destroying icons. In a lot of cases, these icons were already very old at that point, but so you have like people who are destroying icons feeling like they're doing God's work and they're doing the right thing, and then people on the other end being like they're savage, they're ignorant, they just don't appreciate art. And that's a label that iconoclasts have had starting around then and has continued since. So before I get into art that was destroyed and art depicting destruction of art, I want to get into kind of the terminology a little bit more of iconoclasm versus vandalism. So iconoclasm has roots in Greek for words that involve breaking and images. Later during the Reformation, we see the term iconoclast emerge, meaning a breaker or destroyer of images, especially ones meant for religious veneration. After the Reformation, especially when we're looking at the French Revolution at the end of the 18th century, there is more widespread destruction of art, not just religious, but also political and symbolic. And this is where the term vandalism, from the French word vandalisme, comes along. And the term vandal was used to describe barbaric behavior since the 17th century. The Vandals were East Germanic tribe that invaded a lot of Europe, and they were vandal came out of that. And so vandalism is actually the preferred or more often used term for the French Revolution, because a lot of what they were destroying wasn't necessarily religious. It was busts of the monarchy. It was art painted by artists who worked for the kings. So it was really tied more to the ancient regime and the monarchy and kind of the new French Republic trying to erase this memory of the previous controlling body of France. So iconoclasm grew to apply to the destruction of or opposition to any form of art. It no longer is solely religious. And vandalism is largely used to denote ignorant, barbaric destruction of culture, of history, of art. So the semantics and linguistic history aside, the destruction of art has long been controversial. celebrated, villainized, and repeated over many, many centuries and still goes on today, which I'll get into a tiny bit at the end. So it doesn't apply solely to paintings, but to sculpture, photography, architecture, artifacts, and more. You know, when we're looking again at some of the early examples of iconoclasm, there's also images of iconoclasts in art. Goya did this drawing. It's on the cover of this book. We'll put it up on the website. But the way that artists start representing iconoclasts, they depict them like these really dumb-looking drunk dudes.
He's, like, pointing. It's like finger guns.
Yeah, and his eyes are closed, and it's literally titled, "He Doesn't Know What He's Doing." And then there's another one where the guy, like another drawing, this guy is looking back at the viewer and he just looks like a dumb, goofy guy. And it's really interesting because you have these like different sides. There's always two sides at least, of course, but how other artists who felt very threatened by iconoclasts and felt that iconoclasts were, you know, these destroyers of art. And in a lot of cases they were. I'm not like on the side of iconoclasts, but it's more just, you know, like here's the other guy. Like he truly looks
like a caveman.
He does. Yeah, he really does.
He just stumbled into a museum.
Yeah, this guy looks like he's never been to a museum and, like, just walked in here and sees, like, a beautiful bust of a lady and is like, I'm going to chip her up with my my hammer. My big hammer. So
it's funny that they're not depicted in more of a
sinister?
Yeah, that's exactly the word I was thinking.
Yeah.
Sinister word.
Yeah. I think in a lot of cases that's because it was easier, especially for people in Catholic countries like Goya in Spain. Like if you're an artist in a Catholic country and there's, you know, Protestant Reformation and there, you know, there was so much conflict between Catholics and Protestants for like decades and decades and decades. So that if you're like a Catholic artist in a Catholic country, you're going to look at these people as like stupid, you know, mm-hmm. they're just like ignorant. And it was easier to look at them that way and be like, well, they just don't understand good art. They just don't get it. And so that's why I think a lot of times they're depicted like drunk idiots.
And it's more insulting than, like, because, when you kind of throw in, like, something more sinister, evil, that does kind of go hand in hand with kind of being smart. Like, you have to be smart to be kind of, like, evil. Or, I don't know.
The evil mastermind.
Yeah, whereas if you just call someone dumb, that's, I don't know, I think it's worse.
He's a big dumb idiot.
Yeah. It's so interesting.
Levels of insults.
I know, right?
The hierarchy of insults.
And then, of course, when you think of revolutions, there's a lot of destruction of art in many revolutions. So what's really of interest to me is art commemorating the destruction of art. And a lot of times, it's just like, whoa.
There's so many layers. It's so meta.
Yeah. So fucking meta. And particularly with the French Revolution, a lot of this was done through the form of prints. You know, prints, you know, they're so reproducible. And, you know, I have some interesting ones where there's this one that's like a personification of the new French Republic who's clubbing and beheads a bust of King Louis the 16th, 17th, or I'm so bad at Roman numerals.
16th.
Boom.
Yes.
There it is.
I have to just go with my instincts. I don't actually know Roman numerals. I just, the first number that pops in my head, I know up to a certain point.
Because X is 10, V is 5, 1.
So yeah, because when the 1 comes after the V, it's a plus. Bigger, when it comes before, okay, yeah. Got it.
People
we
are
got there.
At us right now.
We did it.
We got have our there. Master's degrees, we swear.
We smart. So, you know, you have like a lot of these. Is Mariah here?
Mariah's here.
Ooh. Hey.
We're going to take a quick break because we have a friend. And we're back talking about iconoclasm.
Yes. So, prints depicting the destruction of art during the French Revolution, but there's also prints and paintings commemorating the dismantling and destruction of buildings, of architecture. So there's actually a lot of paintings and prints of the dismantling of the Bastille from Bastille Day. You know, they storm it. It's a big deal for the revolution. And so these are all symbols of the ancient regime of the monarchy. And so destroying and visually recording that destruction as a means of removing a previous political entity, yet celebrating and commemorating that destruction itself. So the iconoclasm here is politically significant, or iconoclasm and vandalism. I'm going to use the terms interchangeably, and we can still see this today. So an example, I'll just do kind of a more contemporary one, but there's a lot. Stalin's statue/monument was torn down in Budapest in 1956 during Hungary's October Revolution, and there are a lot of pictures. Of course, now it's easier and easier to visually record, in that way, celebrate the destruction of art. And then you have Saddam Hussein's statue, which was toppled in Baghdad in 2003. I'll post the link for that video. Have you guys ever seen it?
No.
It's wild.
And I would like to see
an American tank ends up having to get in and like pull it down because people were like going at it with sledgehammers and trying to get it down, but they couldn't because it was massive. And then an American soldier like crawls up and puts an American flag over Saddam Hussein's face. It's nuts. Like, people are so excited, and just now you're like, shit goes so wrong.
Crazy.
Yeah, it's really, really interesting. And of course, now we've talked about this off and on the podcast, Confederate monuments in the States and statues are toppled over and people spit on them and kick them. And it's obviously a really contentious, controversial thing. So it's not just solely political iconoclasm these days. There's still religiously motivated iconoclasm. So the Buddhas of Bamiyan were huge statues from the 7th century, and they were cut out of rock in the Bamiyan Valley of central Afghanistan. And in 2001, the Taliban blew them up as a part of an iconoclastic campaign and filmed it. ISIS has also destroyed and filmed destruction of architecture, artifacts, and art. And really, regardless of time period, religious belief or lack thereof, political climate, method of destruction, or medium destroyed, iconoclasm and vandalism are incredibly emotionally charged, and it's been going on for centuries in all of these different contexts. So whenever I think a monument or a statue or a building or a work of art is intentionally destroyed, it always speaks to something deeper. It's not usually just kind of like surface level, like, sometimes. But for the most part, there's some really deep meanings underneath it. So that is my introduction to iconoclasm and vandalism.
And just to add to the Bamiyan Buddhas, I was looking this up earlier too, and apparently they have put in projections where they used to be. So there's like light projections of the Buddhas. So now
So it's like with the Twin Towers and they shoot up the lights. Interesting. Okay.
Kind of a unique, cool take on it.
Yeah.
Didn't know that till today. Right. Anyway. All right.
Well, the layers to iconoclasm.
Yeah, dude. Yeah. Tell me about it.
It's like an onion.
It really is.
So this is going to be kind of a theory heavy-ish episode, because I'm also going to talk about some differentiations in a little more contemporary setting. So Bruno Latour is a French writer, philosopher, and he wrote a paper called What is Iconoclash? So not iconoclasm, but iconoclash, which is a term I'm assuming he coined.
Be a really cool name for a band.
Oh my god. Yeah. Yeah.
It would be.
What's up, Austin? We're iconoclasm.
And of course they're in Austin. So, Ginny already did a great job of defining iconoclasm, but I'm just going to kind of frame it a different way. In reference to iconoclasm is when we know why someone's breaking something or what their motivations are. So in all the examples we've talked about, we understand the political, religious motives for destroying a lot of these images. Like, we can rationalize it even if we think that the actual acts are irrational.
Mm-hmm.
And iconoclash is when you see kind of similar examples of destruction or vandalism, but you have to think a little bit harder about the motives or why or who it's affecting. So there's just kind of an overall question mark over the whole thing. And it's a little more provocative. It's
more avant-garde.
It is. And the avant-garde is definitely something that comes up in this a lot. So those are kind of the differentiations. And I like the way he describes, or defines iconoclast. He says, when one does not know, one hesitates, one is troubled by an action for which there is no way to know without further inquiry whether it is destructive or constructive.
you wanna say that again?
Yeah, that was a loud plane.
Post airplane.
There's a little airport right near here. Is that why there's like an airport themed pet hospital that I passed?
Probably. What? Yeah, there's a little like.
I don't know how those things relate.
That's
at
what
all.
I thought. I was like, oh,
that's so odd.
So the way that Latour defines iconoclast is when one does not know, one hesitates, one is troubled by an action for which there is no way to know without further inquiry whether it is destructive or constructive. There's just a lot more room for people to parse through this kind of destruction.
Yeah.
So in his essay, he focuses on three different realms with which iconoclast can occur. So he does science, religion, and art. And it should be noted that this is all kind of like modern contemporary.
For sure.
Because I feel like iconoclasm as it started really kind of phases out mostly as we get into modern times. There's so much of trying to stamp out of other religions or religious objects. It takes on a more modern form. And
oh, definitely.
Yeah. So yeah, science and art being added into the mix. He goes into talking about religion and the idea of the human hand lessening meaning in religious art. So the more that you can see kind of like human-made qualities, the less transcendental the item is.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have like the veil of Mary, that's super holy because it was like bestowed to humans from, you know what I mean? It's like if something lands in your lap that's holy, it's a lot more powerful than a painted icon, essentially. So then what that translates into for contemporary art is that's all that contemporary art is man-made objects, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
The human hand is everywhere in contemporary art. I mean, sometimes that's really all there is.
Yeah.
The human has become God.
Yes, yes. So you could see...
Very, very Nietzsche-esque.
Mm-hmm. Totally. And nihilism ties into all this, and it's all there. So modern art essentially is the epitome of breaking down and experimenting with what art is and what it can be. So it is almost just like a destruction in itself. The evolution of modern art is kind of all about destruction and reduction and whatnot.
Deconstruction,
perfect. And then reconstruction from that.
Right.
And he calls it a maniacal joy in self-destruction.
Wow.
I thought it was great. I had to write that one down. Yeah, so contemporary art as iconoclast is basically defacement and refacement, as he puts it. So he then goes on to talk about the five different types of iconoclastic gestures, and this is really to set up how to figure out what form of iconoclast this is, like the motives, the effects that it will have, the effects that it has before it's destroyed, you know, all of these things. So the first is the inner goals of the icon smashers. So what do they hope to achieve by destroying this object, this icon? The roles they give to the destroyed images. So what does this image symbolize that they feel like needs to be destroyed? The effects this destruction has on those who cherish the images. So how are these people going to react to this image being destroyed? How this reaction is interpreted by the iconoclast, what they're hoping to get from it. The effects of destruction on the destroyer's own feelings. So there's a lot of layers here.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to bring in a contemporary example. The one that seemed most obvious to me are two of, two of Ai Weiwei's pieces. Ones we've talked about on our Ai Weiwei episode, but dropping of a Han Dynasty urn. So the photographed series, it's a triptych of him dropping a Han Dynasty urn.
I was like, what dynasty was that from? The Han Dynasty.
Again, that is Han. H-A-N. So this kind of, I feel like, is a great example of this iconoclast. I mean, he is destroying an item. But you can ask all of these questions, like, why why is he destroying it? What is he hoping to get from people who look at it? And people do react. People get very upset.
Oh, yeah, they do. We looked at this work in theory, didn't we, in our theory seminar?
Oh, I think so.
Where we were kind of talking about these issues, and we looked at it, and I mean, I fucking love Ai Weiwei, and I'm like, I love that work. I think it's brilliant. Mm-hmm. But I remember someone else in our in our seminar was just like very appalled.
It's coming back to me. Yep.
And so, I mean, and that was in a class of like, what, 8 people were in that
small class?
You know? So you get very differing reactions feelings to something like that, which I think speaks to why it's such a great piece.
Yes.
Yeah. Because it evokes those kinds of feelings in
people.
Totally. And then the other example is, again, a Han urn, but it's the Han jar overpainted with Coca-Cola logo, which has been attacked, yes?
Yes, it has. So there's like another layer.
Another layer, So he's taking his urn and he's painting over it with one of the most like famous capitalist imagery, a Coca-Cola logo. And so to a lot of people, that is like the defacement, the destruction of this urn, because you're covering it with this capitalist imagery.
And in some ways, the destruction of history.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then you get a visitor trying to destroy that, and it's just like, oh.
It's like, when does it end?
Right?
I know. Tell me about it.
There's a lot
I think about it often. Will it end? Will it ever end? No, it won't.
Never ever. People like to smash things. Like, that is just a human impulse.
Totally.
I remember in my theater days, like, when I was involved in theater, and we'd have strike at the end of a play, and, like, in my head, it would, like, I was always really excited because I thought we'd get to, like, smash shit, but it was never like that.
Oh.
It was, like, collecting nails and, like...
Oh, wait, what's strike?
Strike is when you take the set down.
Oh, okay.
Oh.
Theater lingo.
I was like, did you go out on strike?
No. So, after the run
of credits,
after the run of a show, strike, and it has a very like physical name. Strike. Strike is when you disassemble the set, and everyone takes part in it. You know, you have to be there for it. And I like would always get excited. Because in my head, even though I did many of these, my head, I was imagining, like, breaking shit.
Sure.
And just, like, tearing down these sets. But it was never like that. It was always a disappointment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, but it's just, like, that human impulse to just, you just want to smash things, you know?
I think they have, like, sites now where you can go and just fuck shit up. Like, you can pay money to put on, like, a helmet and a mask and stuff and just, like... destroy shit with a bat.
Whoa.
Yeah, I actually really want to check it out. It sounds like an amazing way to just release.
Yeah, it's like I think it's like a form of therapy.
Yeah, that's the idea behind it. I think there might be one in Sacramento, actually.
Is there? We could do that.
Yeah, let's go break some shit.
I was going to say, I can think of like 4 people off the top of my head that would want to go and just hit shit.
Oh my god, that'd be so fun if we went and got drinks and then went and just broke some shit. That would be like so fun. We should definitely do that.
Yeah,
okay, so make sure you get on our Instagram, because at some undisclosed point in the future, there will be videos of us just breaking shit.
I feel like somehow I'm going to get hurt doing this.
Yeah,
so I'm going to do it anyway.
Yeah. I'm going to like hit something and it's going to like bounce around.
Right, that's what I imagine. Or like too much momentum and then I just like...
fall.
Yeah, just something like that.
Is that all you got, Nat?
Mm-hmm.
That's it. So I'm just going to talk about a few little anecdotes of basically iconoclasm in the past 100 years or so. It just came to my mind while we were talking about it. Michelangelo's Pieta was...
Yeah.
What happened with that? Any of you know the story?
Yeah. It was...
I don't have any of the details because I just remembered it. But
I want to say... It was a German tourist, but I want to check myself because I don't want to offend any German tourists because they're known for their tourism.
How about you tell the story and I'll fact check you as you tell the story?
So, from what I recall, a tourist possibly German, was in the Vatican and just went at the Pietà with a hammer. I don't remember if there was any logic behind it. And then they pulled him off. Now the Pietà is separated from people behind glass, I think.
It is.
Yes,
bulletproof
glass.
Yes, bulletproof. It is. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Hungarian-born Australian geologist.
Okay.
Geologist.
I'll take the L on that.
Was he trying to, like, free the rock?
Okay. This is coming off Wikipedia, so, you know, take it with a grain of salt. You know how Wikipedia works, at least I hope you do. Laszlo Toth was a Hungarian-born Australian geologist. He achieved worldwide notoriety when he vandalized Michelangelo's Pietà statue on May 21st, 1972.
Yeah.
He was not charged with any criminal offense, which is interesting. He was hospitalized in Italy for 2 years, and on his release...
Well, that is perhaps punishment there.
I know, right? Especially in the 70s.
Yeah.
On his release, he was immediately deported to Australia. Look at this guy.
Real creepy-looking dude. Oh, he actually kind of looks like someone we know.
Yes, he does.
Oh,
yes,
my
God. Thought the same thing.
Whoa.
What?
It all makes sense.
Let me see if I can get a few more details. On May 21st, 1972, at 33 years of age, Jesus's traditional age of death, during the Feast of Pentecost, Toss, wielding a geologist's hammer and shouting, "I am Jesus Christ, risen from the dead," Michelangelo's Pietà statue in St. Peter's Basilica, Vatican City, with 15 blows. He removed...
How the fuck did he do 15 before someone pulled him off the Pietà?
I mean, but would you jump in if you had a hammer?
I don't know. They got those Swiss guards in
the
Vatican.
Swiss guards,
those
guys
aren't messing around.
But I, as a civilian, I would not.
Yeah, I know.
I wouldn't either.
Yeah,
I wouldn't either.
Yeah. I'd be like,
one hammer to the skull.
Sorry, Michelangelo. Like,
do you guys know
the
start, why they're always Swiss guards there? One of the popes, I can't remember which one. It was like, it was a long time ago. It was like either during the Renaissance or a little bit after, said that he only wanted Swiss guards in the Vatican because he couldn't trust the Italian ones because they would be willing to get paid off.
Yeah.
Interestingly, though, it wasn't even the Swiss guards that pulled them off.
What? Yeah.
Toth was subdued by bystanders, including American sculptor Bob Cassily, who hit Toth several times before pulling him away from the Pietà. So, I mean, this had to have just been a very interesting occurrence.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That would
craziness.
Be crazy.
Yeah, like, here's a picture of him, it looks like, right after being subdued.
Whoa, he kind of looks like a Christ being pulled off of the cross.
We'll put this image on our images because it's very interesting.
Oof.
But he's being removed from the Pietà, and there's no Swiss guards. They're just like dudes.
What? Swiss guards were?
Where are you at, guys?
They're not on top of it. To be fair, I don't think I've ever seen any of them actually inside St. Peter's. More just around like the perimeter and throughout the rest of Vatican City.
So that's an interesting one. Glad we looked that up real quick. Another interesting anecdote, going back to the email that we started this episode with. Mary Richardson was a Canadian suffragette, and on March 10th, 1914, she smuggled a, like, meat cleaver into the National Gallery in London and slashed the Rockaby Venus by Diego Velázquez.
Yeah.
Just slashed it. She was protesting the imprisonment and mistreatment of suffragette and political activist Emmeline Pankhurst. She founded the Women's Social and Political Union, the WSPU.
Oh, okay.
So kind of super important in suffragette history, and she was one of the suffragettes that got imprisoned and starved herself and all of that.
Yeah.
Jazz. Mary Richardson vandalized this work the day after Emmeline Pankhurst had been imprisoned multiple times, but one of her imprisonments the day after was when this happened. And she wrote a brief statement: "I have tried to destroy the picture of the most beautiful woman in mythological history, as a protest against the government for destroying Mrs. Pankhurst, who is the most beautiful character in modern history. Justice is an element of beauty as much as color and outline on canvas. Mrs. Pankhurst seeks to procure justice for womanhood, and for this she is being slowly murdered by a government of Iscariot politicians. If there is an outcry against my deed, let everyone remember that such an outcry is an hypocrisy so long as they allow the destruction of Mrs. Pankhurst and other beautiful living women, and that unlike the public cease to countenance human destruction, the stones cast against me for the destruction of this picture are each an evidence against them of artistic as well as moral and political humbug and hypocrisy.
Woo-woo.
Right?
Yeah.
She's a passionate lady.
She's very, heavy. Very passionate.
So I think that kind of sums up her reasoning for it. This is one of those instances where we know exactly why she did it.
Yeah.
But it's just a very interesting thing on multiple levels because, one, you can't ignore the fact that this is an image. It's an image of a nude woman. An image of a nude woman that has, up until this point, had been owned by men,
yes.
by rich, powerful men. Mm-hmm. It was very much created for the male gaze.
Totally.
We have an object of male desire being slashed by a suffragette, but also it takes on this other unexpected layer, I think, at least I didn't expect it, of kind of trying to force us to put our priorities in order.
Yeah.
Like, what is more important, this painting of a woman or an actual woman?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
that is a very important idea.
That's a valid argument.
Yeah. And I think on that level, I mean, yeah, not that the former is a bad argument either, you know, slashing images for the male gaze. I get it. But on a deeper level of humanity, I think this argument that why are we so outraged about a painting
yeah.
of a person
yeah.
when there are actual people, mm-hmm. you know, dying.
For sure.
And being mistreated. So that was her main argument, which is something to think about. It also, there's an interesting thing with the outrage surrounding the painting. So the painting had recently been accrued by the National Gallery in London, but it was bought as the result of money raised by the public.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of a big moment for just London. Like, it was a big, there was a lot of patriotism almost surrounding it,
for
you know?
Sure.
Like, there was
yeah.
this idea
yeah.
of, like, this is, like, because the public did it. The painting cost €45,000 in 1914, so
mm-hmm.
that's a good amount of money. It had been acquired via public support, so a lot of people were angry because they felt like it was an attack on London and
yeah.
the people of London. Not that I necessarily agree with that,
yeah.
but that's,
yeah, yeah, yeah,
that's
yeah.
what a lot of people, their outrage had something to do with, like, nationalist concerns,
totally.
I guess.
Yeah.
What's also interesting is the argument that she makes that you just read is a good one.
Yeah,
but,
definitely.
Like, I was reading somewhere else in relation to this that she had said something about being bothered about men, like, ogling at it in
mm-hmm.
the gallery and stuff. That, I feel like, to bring that part up, because when you hear her give that whole spiel,
right.
then obviously the men ogling is secondary. But I feel like people trying to make it primary is, like, trying to lessen the effect of what she did and trying to, like, bring it back down and being like, oh, she's just...
It's all about female sexuality
yeah.
again, you know?
And, like, and that's upsetting.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I'm not claiming that that's not part of it and that doesn't
no,
add
but
unnecessary...
to try and make it a bigger piece
yeah.
of the puzzle than it actually
when
she
made
be.
A clear statement
mm-hmm.
about what she was trying to say. And granted, she probably chose that painting partially, yes, for that reason, but the statement should be more important, I feel
totally.
like her saying what her reasoning was should be more important than yeah than this sexualizing of
yes.
women argument.
Yeah.
You know, to contemporary times, that's such a big feminist issue, is, like, does everything come down to female sexuality? Like, why is every argument, everything, like, why is it all about our sexuality? Like,
yeah.
it does not, like, we are more than just, you know, sexual beings or beings that are
yeah.
meant to be sexualized.
Right.
And
right.
it's like, well, those
so
are...
so hard to reprogram people to not think that.
Exactly.
It's so deep-rooted.
I know. It's crazy.
Oof.
So that's Mary Richardson. Another interesting fact about her, though, is after this happened, years after the fact, she became a fascist.
I saw that.
Yeah, which is kind
of insane.
Yeah, it's crazy, and it's kind of funny to me because fascists love to destroy art. So, like, I just thought that was kind of like,
oh, so maybe she just really liked destroying art.
But
she's like, need more, need more.
From what I read,
are over. What's next?
From what I read, she felt that the fascists had a certain something that the suffrage movement didn't have.
They had something. They, I don't know that was a good thing.
Yeah.
No, it wasn't.
Yeah, like
thing.
Mussolini, but like, come on.
Yeah, but I mean, it kind of makes her a very interesting, complex character. Like,
yeah,
right?
Certainly, no, it does.
Like,
it does.
Those are just, those are some interesting layers to her story, and it took quite the turn.
Nothing is black and white, people.
Yeah. For real.
There are no heroes and villains, it's all a mix.
we're all in the gray area. You die a hero, or you live long enough to see yourself become the villain.
Oh, God.
That sounds like it's from Batman.
It is from Batman.
Wait.
No,
what?
I love
that you quoted Batman and that you knew it was from Batman.
I love Batman. I'm not a big superhero person, never have been, but the Batman trilogy, what's his face is, well, I can't think of his name.
Michael Keaton?
No. Christian Bale.
Christian Bale, but why
the
can't
Dark
I,
Knight.
Why can't I think of the director's name? I love the director.
Nolan.
Thank you. Christopher Nolan's Batman trilogy is,
I don't even know.
Oh, girl. We are going to have
they're
a marathon
so
night. They're so good.
Oh, they're actually really, really good
interesting
movies.
They are good. I think you'd really like them.
Someone just told me yesterday that they have a 35-year-old cousin who loves Batman and still wears, like, Batman paraphernalia and slept at her parents' house and was like, oh, I had the best night's sleep. I slept in the closet. It's like a bat cave, and she was wearing, like, Batman pajamas with a cape.
I feel like Batman,
like,
he sucks people in because he's human. That's
exactly
what, no, a lot of people relate to him because he's completely mortal, and Christopher Nolan does a great job, like, showing the, like, human qualities of Batman in those, because I haven't seen any of the previous ones, but I'm guessing they don't show him as being that, like,
human.
The Michael Keaton version is an entirely different thing.
Yeah,
hilarious.
Like, he's
so great.
So mortal. And,
so. And they're beautiful movies.
Yeah.
Like, they're shot really well, and they're dark. Like, they're interesting, and they're dark.
They
and
are.
Also, Heath Ledger's
okay,
Joker.
I did see that one then.
So good.
So I have seen at least one.
We need to watch
that's
the whole trilogy,
one.
Though.
Okay.
No, that's the second one.
Oh, it is?
Heath Ledger's in the second one.
Oh.
Yeah, The Dark Knight is probably the best, but the whole trilogy is fantastic.
They're all good, though.
Yeah.
You think it's going to get bad. It never does.
How did we get here?
I quoted Batman. anyways. But I have one last anecdote about Iconoclasm. This one's kind of just goofy. Like, I kind of love it in a weird way. It happened in 2012. You may have heard of it. A gentleman went to the National Gallery of Ireland, and he just punched a Monet. And I personally love that he didn't have an axe, and he just punched it. Like, to me, there's something so much more, like, he, like, it's like he had it out for the Monet. Like, there's more contact. Like, he was just, like, going for
it. Wanted
it
to be
it.
A fair fight.
Yeah. Exactly. I don't know. I just, the second I heard about this, I remember hearing about it right when it happened. And I, like, wasn't mad. I just thought it was hilarious.
Yeah.
So, the name of the painting is Argentual Basin with a Single Sailboat. And 40
sounds infuriating.
It does. It
single,
makes me mad.
Single sailboat. 49-year-old Andrew Shannon punched the painting as a way to, quote, get back at the state.
Oh.
No more specifics. Than,
like,
no specifics were given. That was about
my
it.
My God.
During his trial, he retracted the statement and claimed it was an accident.
Good lawyer.
That he fell faint and fell into the work.
Got
Gotta love that lawyer.
Oh, God.
Painting was worth $10 million. And in 2014, because there was camera footage of what actually happened, so it wasn't a very good defense. But in 2014, Shannon was sentenced to 5 years in prison.
Fuck.
Whoa.
For punching a
That's
mummy.
Really steep.
That is. I read somewhere earlier that the max sentence used to be 6 months. There was, I think, Mary Richardson.
Yeah,
I think
yeah.
The max sentence at that time was 6 months.
Yeah, I didn't even say that. Mary Richardson was sentenced to 6 months in jail for...
And
this dude got 5 years.
To be fair, he had some other stuff, too.
Oh, okay.
So
okay.
I don't know if they were tried together, but
I'm sure it didn't help.
Yeah. I'm guessing that got added in because
for sure.
I was like, holy shit, too. So he punched the painting... And then he shouted at gallery visitors.
Wow.
And then the security guard that, like, held him back found a can of paint stripper on his person. So, obviously, he had some intentions.
For sure.
Can you
imagine going to a museum and all of a sudden someone starts attacking
yelling at you, like, fuck all that.
The mindset that I'm in when I'm at a museum compared to that setting.
I know.
I would be so panicked.
I would too, because they're usually very quiet.
Yeah.
And same thing with being in St. Peter's. Like, I've been in that. Like, if someone just jumped up with a hammer, being like, "I am Jesus Christ." So alarming.
No, right? No, definitely.
Oh, and I've read, what is it? The, what's that book about the bombing in the
Goldfinch?
The Goldfinch. Mm-hmm. I've read that book, and that scene is so descriptive of, like, all that horror.
Oh, it is.
So I feel like if I heard someone shouting in a museum, I would just...
That scene goes on for, like, chapters.
It really does.
That
scene is so long. I started that book twice, because the first time I didn't make it through the first
time. It's so long, but it is really
good. And once you get off...
I feel like, a book we could talk about at a later time, because Goldfinch is art historical lit.
Maybe that could be a bonus episode.
Oh, but, that would be a good one. The I also recently read On Beauty by Zadie Smith, which is really good. I really love her a lot and want to read more of her books, but one of the main characters is an art historian. So there's some fun kind of interweaving with art history. I really like that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Like fiction, like contemporary fiction that interplays with art history.
Yeah, sure.
Makes me happy. But due to Punch the Monet, so yeah, he got the 5 years in prison, but like I said, I don't know for a fact that these are tied together, but I assume they were. Police raided Shannon's house and found 48 stolen items worth more than $100,000.
Okay, that's why he went to prison for 6 years.
Yeah. I'm guessing they were, like, tried together.
For sure.
I mean, also, like...
He sounds like a weirdo.
What was the damage?
Yeah, to get the Monet repaired was in the 5 digits, though.
Shit.
So...
I'm sure that took forever.
Yeah.
Maybe still.
So that cost hella money, too. Also, 15 months after his release, he's not allowed in any art gallery. Anywhere.
That's probably good.
I also found, honestly, it doesn't work very well. I was kind of bummed out, but you can check it out. Maybe it's my computer. There's a website, punchamonet.gallery. And it's literally just like there's a hand at the, and you can move it and you can punch
him. Oh, my God. That's ridiculous. The internet.
It's a beautiful place.
Just for you listeners to emphasize why the punching is so, like, kind of sincere sounding, is these are the categories on Wikipedia for vandalizing art. Acid and paint, knife, smashing and shattering, lipstick, and firearms and other tools. So people get
lipstick.
Creative. Yeah.
Lips.
Oh, like
lipstick.
Just maybe drawing, like,
I just imagine someone, like, making out with a painting.
Yeah, that's what it is. It's wearing lipstick and then kissing paintings or sculptures, and yeah.
Is that as an act of vandalism, or is it an act of love?
I think it depends. The first example was in 1912, and a woman kissed the forehead and eyes of a portrait by Frances Boucher in the Louvre, and she wanted to draw attention to herself. Very honest.
Actually, that makes... Okay, like... And if any work was going to be, like, defiled by kisses, it would be Francois Boucher, I feel like.
But then...
Like, it's, you know, it's so sugary and, like...
Yeah.
That makes sense.
It does.
Then there was a woman at the Oxford Museum of Modern Art who claimed that she was cheering up a cold painting.
I love it!
And her only, yeah, she just had to pay the restoration costs. That's fair.
Cheering up a cold painting? Now, yeah. That's beautiful.
Ooh, this one, 2007. This woman, Rindy Sam, kissed all over Phaedrus, which is the all-white Twombly.
Ooh.
Yeah, and that was estimated to be worth $2,830,000.
Dang.
Yeah, the first attempt to remove using about 30 various chemicals were unsuccessful. She was tried in court for voluntary degradation of a work of art. Defended herself saying, "It was just a kiss, a loving gesture. I kissed it without thinking. I thought the artist would understand. It was an artistic act provoked by the power of art." £1,000 to the owner, £500 to the gallery, and £1 to the painter.
What? I think this actually, I have one last question that I wanted to ask you guys, and this leads into it perfectly. Because, okay, so we're talking about modernism. We're talking about an all-white painting by Cy Twombly, which is already super modern and kind of confusing for a lot of people. And in my opinion, as I love Cy Twombly, not worth millions of dollars. That's too much fucking money. Yeah, but just her talking about the experience of kissing it and why she did it and how it being an act of art, in my opinion, like, I kind of buy it. If we buy that Cy Twombly's white painting is art, then we buy that that act is art.
Yeah.
And so essentially, this leads me to big overarching question of all this. Do these acts of vandalism diminish artworks, or do they add value to them?
Ooh, that's a good question.
I feel like in a lot of cases, they, well, value to. I mean, I think they can add a lot to the fame or, like, notoriety of works of art because it just generates that much more visibility, which can connect to value. You know, right? Like, if a painting is, like, kissed with coral lipstick and then it's restored and then it's later sold at Christie's and you're like, oh, that's that painting by that artist, but it also was kissed by that woman. I'll pay for it.
That's definitely.
Hang it up my house.
And can you imagine having, let's say, even if it's been restored, or even if there's, like, rent, like, what if that all-white painting, there's still, if you look really, really close, you can see the outline of lips, like, does that add something? Because to me, I think that adds something very interesting.
It kind of
certainly
does,
interesting.
But yeah. Like, because if you think about it, what if you were to be like, oh, we could just leave it? But then that could kind of perpetuate this idea that if people did things like that, that they would be elevated. It's almost like we were talking about My Favorite Murder earlier, and it's like, I really like that podcast, but there is a part of you that, like, things like that podcast, things like Criminal Minds and Law and Order and all these shows, like, there's such a fine line between bringing awareness to things like this and, like, trying to almost take the power and fear away from it by talking about it and hyping it up and making it, I'm like, elevating it to something that it's not. You know what I mean? It's such a fine line, and it depends on the people.
I totally agree. I think it's complicated because we also don't want to
encourage the defacement of art.
Exactly, but at the same time, these stories are really interesting and they're artistic in their own way, you know?
Yeah.
And they added a new layer to the lifespan of the artwork, and that's pretty beautiful. And like I said, I mean, this is very, like, coming from a personal place. Like, I adore Ai Weiwei's dropping of a Han Dynasty urn, so that kind of already tells you how I feel, you know?
But, like, that comes into ideas of ownership and stuff, and he bought it and he owned it. You know what I mean? Versus
Very true.
And I think that's where it gets a little tricky, too. And I think that tying back to the iconoclash and talking about motives and who it affects and how it affects them and all of these things are kind of important when talking about this because there are so many layers and there,
there's
a lot of question marks when it comes to modern day defacement of art.
Yeah.
Definitely.
It's a lot to unpack.
It really is. Yeah. Do we have anything else to say about iconoclasm?
I don't think so.
Mariah, do you have anything to say about
our friend is here.
Mariah's just hanging out, watching, you know.
You may have heard a faint giggle at certain points, but other than
Well,
that,
she also saved the day with the Christopher Nolan thing. So.
Yeah, that was Mariah.
Oh, this is a good one. This is from our friend Renee. She sent us wine before, so She's certainly our friend.
Shout out, Renee!
So this is in response to our The Art of Boxing episode a while back. Hey, babes. I just finished listening to the boxing episode. My husband is a boxing promoter, so having lived this sport or avoided for 25 years, it was interesting to hear your thoughts. Of course, as I was sitting on the freeway, I kept jumping into the conversation. Some of my thoughts. Yes, it is very much a show slash performance. Yes, when my husband matches a fight, he can pretty much tell you how many rounds it will go and who will win. Every now and then, there is an upset. Styles make fights. I don't enjoy it personally, but I do see it as an art. All the best, Renee.
Well said, Renee. Yeah, that was a really...
good perspective.
Yeah.
Because I don't know anyone that, boxes or is close to it.
Yeah.
My dad tried to teach me how to do a proper punch when I was, like, you know, 13. Just like, just so you know,
don't put your thumb.
And that was it.
The same lesson. When I was little, I told you on the boxing episode I took taekwondo for a long time when I was little. And we were in the basement one day, and I was like, Dad, I'm going to show you something I learned. And he was like, okay. And I stepped on his feet. And I just, like, punched him.
Oh, my God.
And he was like...
Or you just made an uppercut motion for me listening. Oh,
and it was something I had learned in taekwondo.
Yeah, of course.
And he was just, like, so... I mean, he was, like, proud of me, but he was just, like, so taken back. Because I, like, legitimately, like, hurt him a little bit.
Yeah.
Like, he did
not... Oh, you punched him, like, in his chin?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought, like, you were a child and you, like, punch him...
Oh, no, 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 okay. No. No, so I stood on his feet.
Hardcore.
It was some sexism, this dad. No, it was something I'd learned in taekwondo where you stand on the assailant's feet.
Sure.
And then you, like, uppercut them in the chin. Like, you punch them, and I just, like, punch them. And, I mean, I was little... thing, but still he just didn't see it coming.
Yeah.
And it actually like caused him
exactly
to like
supposed to go.
Yeah. And he was just like he was like kind of mad at first, but then he was like more proud than anything. So yeah, that's really the extent of my experience with those kind of things. I love getting emails like that. I really love these like response emails to the things we say because a lot of our ideas just come from a place of interest, not necessarily expertise. So we really appreciate any feedback we get. Thank you so much, Renee. We're going to schedule that beach house visit very soon.
Yeah.
That's going to be amazing. Thanks for listening to our Iconoclasm episode. Make sure to check out our Patreon.
Yes.
Patreon.com/arthistorybabes. We started dropping extra episodes. They're quality.
Top notch.
So check out our Patreon. Write us a review on iTunes. We've gotten a bunch of great new ones. We really appreciate it. Facebook, Instagram, Art History Babes Podcast. You know how it is. arthistorybabes@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.
Bye. Goodbye. Goodbye. Goodbye.
Sounds like you're saying, what was his name?
Gavon.
Oh,
Gavon.
I was like, Guy Fieri?
I'm watching so much Guy Fieri lately.
Did you guys see that? I posted it on our Twitter. It was someone put Guy Fieri's face on Renaissance.
It's amazing.
It's amazing.
It was perfect.
It's amazing.
Oh my God.
The Art History Babe.
Ryan's gonna be here in 10 minutes.
Great. I love all these little leaves falling out here. It's just
I know.
Like so pleasant.
I can hear them.
Just a little crackle, crackle.